Thanks for inviting me into your home, long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed rec room with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the paintings of dogs playing poker, your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and tonight, this morning, I'm coming to you from my little studio beneath the stairs in Old Thornhill, just north of Toronto. For the last 20 years of Albert Einstein's life, almost all of his colleagues believed he contributed almost nothing of importance to physics. In the early part of the 20th century, Einstein developed general relativity, a field theory of gravitation. His theory of special relativity, developed in 1905, is a scientific theory regarding the relationship between space and time, and it forms part of the basis for modern physics. But his critics argued that for decades after, Einstein squandered his genius pursuing a pipe dream, the creation of a unified field theory to describe all the forces of nature, a theory in which electromagnetism and gravity would emerge as different aspects of a single fundamental field. Shortly before his death, Einstein wrote, "Our situation is the following. We are standing in front of a closed box which we cannot open, and we try hard to discover about what is and is not in it." Mark Fiorentino has spent 50 years trying to pry open that box, and he believes he's done it. He believes he's solved the unified field theory, and in so doing, cracked open the secrets of anti-gravity, superluminal motion or faster-than-light speed, and even time travel. Open lines, of course, in the second half. Before we get to that, it's time for a visit from the sublime scoundrel of the paranormal, professional lunatic, pioneering founder of Banal of America, and of course, news editor for Coast to Coast AM. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well, Richard. Great to talk to you again.
Likewise, my friend. Now, tell me about this amazing house for sale in Australia. It looks like something right off the set of Space 1999, if you remember that show.
Yeah, I was blown away when I heard about this. My friend down in Australia, Sarah, tipped me off to this story that this house had gone on the market. It's known in the community of Carralee as the Bubble House. And it was built in the 1980s by an architect. At that time, he was an architecture student, Graham Birchall. This was his graduate thesis, an ode to strength, beauty, and simplicity of the humble circle is how he described it. And what it is this massive house that it consists of 11 connecting domes that range from 13 to 26 feet in diameter. And folks can check it out at the Coast to Coast AM website. It's in the 3 slot in the carousel. And it went on the market this week. It went on the market on Monday. So they, for the first time ever, a lot of folks in the neighborhood, they had walked by it. Of course, they had seen the Bubble House. It's been a fixture of the community for like 30 years. No one knew really what it looked like inside. So there's a video there from the realtor that takes people into the Bubble House. And it's as fantastic inside as it is outside. It's really a one-of-a-kind, amazing residence. If I won the lottery, I'd probably be in the market for it. So we'll see.
Well, do we know how much would it set you back to buy the Bubble House, Tim?
Well, the remarkable thing is they don't have an asking price. They're just looking, they're sort of putting out feelers. So they're looking for anyone with an offer. But the general idea is for a house about that size in that area, a quote unquote normal house, would fetch at least $1 million. So I would imagine it would be more than $1 million, right? Unless nobody wants the Bubble House. But there's been a lot of interest in it, so I expect it'll go for over $1 million.
All right. I certainly wouldn't want to paint it. Let's put it that way. Next, this is a very touching story. A ghost photographed, a child's ghost photographed at the graveyard in New Mexico. Tell me more.
Yeah, this one really makes you think. Sandra Gonzalez's daughter, Fabiola Rodriguez, she passed away nearly 2 years ago when she was just 2 years old. She's buried at this graveyard in Las Cruces, New Mexico. In recent weeks, her mom noticed that toys and personal items had gone missing at the grave. And another family nearby, who had a loved one buried nearby, noticed that someone had been sort of defacing the gravestone. So they set up a camera to possibly catch the culprit who was behind this. They didn't spot the person who was doing any desecrating, but what they wound up capturing were these fantastic, just jaw-dropping pictures of what, I mean, there's no other way to put it. It looks like an apparition, a very clear apparition of a little girl at the grave of Fabiola Rodriguez, and this would be in the middle of the night. So this is not in the afternoon or anything like that. This is in the dead of night. There appears to be a toddler visiting the grave, and the family that set up the camera, they brought it to the people who run the cemetery because they were concerned, because, like, well, there's a kid running around in the cemetery at night. And they looked at the thing, the pictures, and they knew immediately that this was Fabiola Rodriguez, the toddler's grave. So her mom thinks it was her visiting the spot. I mean, I'll be honest, I think it was, too. It really is.
I'm with you. Tim. Picture.
It really is one of the best ghost pictures I think I've ever seen. It's stunning.
And there's a picture of the little girl that passed away as well alongside it, and it does, for all the world, look like her. This is amazing. And people, where will they find this in the Coast to Coast website?
That's in the number 2 slot at the Coast to Coast AM website. Definitely get up and check that one out, folks. It will really blow you away.
All right, so finally, we have another video. This one in Iceland, a mystery creature perhaps caught on video. Tell me about it.
Yeah, this one is really weird, a real head-scratcher, and the Coast website visitors went wild for this one this week. I'm not even going to try and pronounce her name. An Icelandic musician, I guess I'll do it, Vigdis Hauser Harðardóttir. There we go.
Wow, well done.
Thank you. She was visiting a massive waterfall in Iceland, the Dettifoss waterfall. I think it's the second biggest one in Iceland, with her boyfriend, just a trip out, and, taking pictures, as we do when we visit these sites around the country, around the world, and taking some video. She took a video of the waterfall. Later on, she got home. She's, as it often happens with these cases, she's looking at the video, and she sees what. And folks can go to the Coast to Coast AM website. It's in the number 1 slot. We've given it the red circle treatment. We've circled it so folks can see it. And you can go on to the article and see the video. It pops out. This little black thing pops out from behind the cliff and kind of hangs around a little bit and then disappears behind the cliff. It's really – I had to watch it several times, and I still don't quite know what it is. You want to guess, maybe if you're a skeptic, you want to guess like it's a trash bag that got stuck there or something. But this doesn't look like anything that you would imagine a place where a trash bag would be. It's a very, very strange video. I challenge the Coast listeners and the website visitors to go and check it out in the number 1 slot and see if you can decipher what it was, because I'm baffled.
Well, if I could throw in my 2 cents, whatever this thing is, it looks like it's wearing a motorcycle helmet.
Yeah, it definitely looks like the head of something like that. That a lot of people, because it's Iceland. Apparently, this waterfall is a stone's throw from where legend has it is the capital city of the elves. So with all of that mythos behind it, a lot of people have suggested maybe she filmed an elf. So I don't know. It's pretty wild.
All right, Tim. Always full value. Thank you so much, Tim Bernal, the news editor of Coast to Coast AM, and he teaches Danish in his spare time, apparently. All right. When we come back, the unified field theory solved, perhaps. Mark Fiorentino is next. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler. Hang your cloak on a peg. Grab a stool and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, sitting in for George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Mark Fiorentino is the author of Master of Reality, Super Relativity, The Unified Field Theory, a book about the completion of Einstein's unified field theory. Mark spent most of his life working in the high-tech industry, starting out as an electronic technician at Harris Government Systems, located in Palm Bay, Florida. He worked on a killer satellite missile guidance system. He taught himself computer programming and used that knowledge to develop a program to failure analysis faulty electronic circuit boards. He received a prestigious division award for helping the company save millions of dollars by preventing difficult-to-fix circuit board assemblies from being thrown away. He received outstanding achievement awards for those projects as well. He retired early in 2016 so that he could compile all of his notes that he had concerning the study of the history of physics, focusing on Einstein and his research. Mark Fiorentino, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
I want to start out with your early fascination with Einstein. And it's interesting reading your biography because you had, well, there's a lot of sort of serendipity happening with you and Mr. Einstein. Explain.
Well, yeah. As it turns out, we were just 20 miles apart. He lived in Princeton and I lived in a town called Middlesex, just a little bit away. And I was born on his birthday and born just about 35 days before he passed away in a hospital just down the road from where I was born. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting little things going on there.
And you were 10 years old when you became, I'll use the word obsessed. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but it sounds like, based on reading your material, that you were obsessed with Einstein's work at 10. I mean, I was playing in the sandbox at age 10. Maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but tell me about what was it at that such an early age that caused you to gravitate, pun intended, towards Einstein?
Yeah, it's a good question. It is kind of a little strange because the nuns at the church I was going to, I was taking catechism class, asked me to find, somebody that was born on my birthday that was a saint, and I couldn't find anybody. And when I went to look at the calendar in the kitchen, I saw that Einstein was born on my birthday. So I opened up the encyclopedia, and I remember sitting on the floor and reading about Einstein. And it just impressed me. And then when I read the section on the unified field theory, that struck me as so sensible and important. I remember to this day thinking, this is the best idea I've ever heard. This is something I got to learn more about. And then from then on in, after that, every movie, every TV show, every book I would read, even things to do with UFOs, anything that had to do with forces and science, I tried to relate it to the unified field theory in some way. So it was always running in the back of my mind as things were going on, as I was watching television shows like Star Trek and reading and so forth. It was always there. Present, always working on it.
I've tried to read his paper on relativity, and actually it's pretty straightforward. I mean, he didn't use fancy mathematical equations. It was just kind of algebra, really. And he called them thought experiments. I mean, the text is actually pretty clear, but even still, it's pretty heady stuff. Could I get you, just to set the table for us as we begin this discussion, because we need to define some terms. So let's talk about the general theory of relativity, and then we'll get into the unified field theory and what he was trying to do. But let's start with relativity.
Yeah, the general theory of relativity is basically describing a curvature of space-time on one part of the equation, and on the other part of the equation is how particles and stuff move versus that curvature. So it basically, the general relativity theory was describing the curvature of space, accurately describing it. It didn't really give us the source of the gravitational field, so that question was still open. And I was very curious about that, and I kept digging, looking for information over the years to find out the origin of mass and the origin of gravity, which is basically the same thing. And so basically that's what general relativity is at a very high level. And that's basically it. So I continued on studying general relativity and studying special relativity too, because that's very much, in my opinion, misinterpreted today. There's a lot of problems with how they interpret the motion and what it's relative to, and it's not correct according to my theory, the interpretation that they have.
So let me just back up here. So general relativity has to do with gravity, right? Like, for example, the sun, the mass of the sun affects time-space because of gravity.
So it's like this. Matter tells space-time how to curve, and curved space-time tells matter how to move. That's it in a nutshell.
All right, so that's general relativity. What's special relativity?
Well, special relativity is a very interesting story in that there's a set of Lorentz transformations that were used to help describe space and time in a special case of non-accelerating motion. And what's interesting about it, those equations that were used in special relativity were first done by Lorentz, who was an ether specialist, as was Einstein. And those original equations and the theory was really modeled on an ether theory. But there was something going on at that time that Einstein was aware of, an experiment called the Michelson-Morley experiment.
And okay, I don't want to get too deep into the reads here. First of all, what do you mean by ether?
Ether is the, as you said in the beginning of the show, electromagnetism and gravity emerge as aspects of a single fundamental field. Ether is that single fundamental field. It is the substance it's a low-density, high-tension, transparent, smooth, and continuous quasi-elastic material. So it's a substance. It's the only thing there is in reality, according to my theory. And basically, that's what Einstein believed in the end of his life.
So is that what we mean when we're talking about space? We're talking about ether?
Yes. And my theory is the exact same thing.
Okay, so then the unified field theory, does this have to do with electromagnetism or what?
Well, it's that fundamental field. There are the other forces. Electromagnetism, what I did was deconstruct it and say there's an electrostatic field. That's a continuous field. It's a certain type of bending of the ether. Then the magnetic field, that's another type of bending. It's a torsional reaction or a twist or a rotation of space. The electrostatic field is like a twist of space. And when the electrostatic field moves around that field, the magnetic field emerges. So that's the electromagnetic field. But the electromagnetic field will never happen unless the electrostatic charge moves. So that's two-thirds of the unified field theory. Then the last third was gravity, which is a contraction of space. So that's another type of bending of that fundamental field. So those aspects are really different types of bending of the fundamental ether field.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes going into the break here. So here's an impossible task. In 2 minutes or less, and we will continue after the break, obviously, drilling down further. But why does this matter to me sitting here in my little studio beneath the stairs or someone listening at home? How does the unified field theory affect them? Why does it matter?
Well, it's for people who are curious and they want to know how things work, and there's a lot of us out there like that. This is the core of understanding. This is what Einstein wanted to know. And basically the people want to know how God created this world, as Einstein said. He wasn't interested in this or that phenomena, in this spectrum or this or that element. He wanted to know the thoughts of God. And I think people need to know that, and we need to know how things work. It's a matter of extending our evolution. We have to know the truth, or we won't stop looking. All these physicists won't stop until this is solved. And I believe I now solved it, and that answer is in the book in high detailed descriptions. So,
and presumably, as we'll discuss after the break, presumably by cracking this and solving the unified field theory, this will enable us to do certain things that we haven't been able to do prior. I'm thinking again about anti-gravitics and superluminal speed
exactly
and so forth.
Right.
We'll pick this up on the other side. The FBI apparently had a huge file on Albert Einstein. In 1933, they began keeping a dossier on Albert shortly before his third trip to the U.S. This file would grow into 1,427 pages of documents, which focused on Einstein's lifelong association with pacifist and socialist organizations. J. Edgar Hoover even recommended that Einstein be kept out of America by the Alien Exclusion Act. But luckily for all of us, J. Edgar was overruled by the U.S. State Department. More of my conversation with Mark Fiorentino as we delve into the mysteries of the universe when Coast to Coast AM returns. Mark Fiorentino, the author of Master of Reality, Super Relativity, The Unified Field Theory. Mark, so what was the stumbling block for Einstein? Why wasn't he able to complete this unified field theory?
Ah, good question. He was born too early. If he had been born 50 years later, he would have known about something that he was missing. He needed a vital piece of information, and that information was he needed to know that inside the neutron and proton were three quarks. He was struggling with all kinds of ideas about how to generate the gravitational field, but he needed the dynamical geometry model, which he was just kind of guessing at in his head. Had he known that three quarks existed, which was only known 10 years after he passed away, I think he would have solved it, and this whole situation would have been resolved many years, decades ago. But he didn't know about that, and thanks to the internet and studying, I was able to use that information to develop the model for the origin of mass and gravity.
Okay, so let's talk about gravity, because it seems to me, with my very simple mind, that we can observe it. We know what gravity does. We can watch it like the wind through the trees. But my sense is you will know better, obviously, but we really don't know what it is. Is that a fair assessment? We don't know what it is, what causes it, where it comes from?
That's true. The origin is still a mystery up until my book, and I explain it very simply. It's a contraction of space, but how? What's the mechanism that creates that? And basically, it's gravity is created by unbalanced charges moving in an accelerated fashion, which causes space to contract around the particle. It's just that simple. So gravity comes about as the action of the quarks inside of neutrons and protons accelerating. Acceleration is the key that Einstein said was the same as gravity. So now I'm giving you the physical explanation. What's exactly accelerating and how it interacts with the space, which causes the contraction as particles accelerate, like inside of the proton and the neutron. As they do this, they form like a sphere that's spinning very fast, and you can use the moment of inertia calculation or formula to calculate or generate the mass that's done by this type of motion. And it's really just that simple. That's the key to understanding gravity, in that it's always been, like Einstein thought, it was about particles interacting with space, not particles interacting with other particles, as the quantum mechanics theory states. And that's why they have failed these past 100 years to come up with a gravitational theory. They've tried 28 times to make it a particle-to-particle interaction, usually with the mythological particle called the graviton, which has never been found. So that explains why they keep failing, because they're using the wrong model. Einstein had the right model all along. He just didn't know that final detail about the quarks.
And what are quarks?
They're little tiny particles that exist inside of the neutron and proton, and they're moving in a very special pattern in there. They're actually thirds of a charge of an electron or a positron, and they move in a trefoil-type pattern inside of the neutron and the proton. That's part of my theory. It's a very important point to note that that pattern is a trefoil motion, which is a discovery I made, and it's listed and talked about in the book. So that's the key to causing gravity or mass. And electrons move in that same orbital type of accelerated motion, and that's the link. It's always been about accelerated motion through space that causes a contraction. So the quarks are just these little tiny particles that exist inside of the neutron and the proton.
And when you say it causes a contraction of space, what does that mean? Because I think you described space earlier as ether, right? So now we're talking about ether contracting?
Yes.
So what does that mean?
Well, it's a substance. So when I say it's a quasi-elastic material, what does that mean? Quasi means that when you bend it a certain way with a force, like a field, when you remove that field, it pops back into a straight, flat, Euclidean geometry. So the ether is a material and a material substance, and particles are made up of it. They're the same as it. They are just configurations of it. So you have to understand that they're an honest part of the field itself, particles. So fields are forces, and they are just simply different types of bending of space, or deformations, you might say. And so gravity is a deformation, a specific type of contraction of space. So that's basically how the system works, and that's how I link the fields together by saying, quite simply, they're different types of bending of the fundamental field, which is the ether field.
Okay, so now that you have figured out what gravity is, how it works, what can we do with it? What can you do with that information?
Very, very good. I mean, you touched on this earlier. When I realized that gravity was a contraction of space, I said, well, if it contracts, it could expand. And then that would be the opposite of gravity. So I learned how I found a mechanical method for doing that and causing an expansion of space. And anti-gravity is where we need to go next. We need to use anti-gravity propulsion. It's very important. This is a very great use for the discovery of the unified field theory, because I just extrapolated to come up with the anti-gravity field theory, which is basically if you can cause space to be stretched, and you can do that using electrons moving in a non-accelerated manner through cables, conducting cables of superconducting wire, you can create a strong magnetic field, and a magnetic field is a rotation of space which causes space to be stretched. And when you do that, it expands, and that's what you need for an anti-gravity field. Very simple. It's not very complicated. All you need to do is use a magnetic field to stretch space, and you will get a gravity shielding effect and an anti-gravity effect that can be used for propulsion. So that's the real benefit to mankind, because we could build all kinds of wonderful hovercrafts, and we can also build ships that can go beyond the speed of light, which I discuss in the book.
Right. So in Master of Reality, Super Relativity, the Unified Field Theory, I'm going to use the term open source this information, right? You want the world to know how you did it. Why would you open source something like that?
Because I want humanity to advance. I just simply want to create or help contribute to a utopian world. I didn't try to patent it. I'm not going to try to do that. It's not about, patenting something and making $1 billion or whatever. I figured that it just needs to happen. It's the time for it to happen so that we can commercialize, bring this technology to all the world, and we can do wonderful things with it. It will save millions of lives. There's many, many applications that can be used with this technology, and we can travel to other star systems. We can colonize planets just in case this one has a problem. There's a lot of important things that need a lot of work to be done and a lot of important things that can be accomplished by using this technology and bringing it forward. So that's why I'm open sourcing it, as well as we need to prove the theory, and we do it by doing the experiment that I proposed in the last chapter of the book, which is basically what you're referring to as open sourcing. I'm telling everybody, this is the secret. This is how you do it. Do this experiment. You'll prove it. You'll verify it. I am 100% confident that this will be proven. The only thing to get in our way, there's two things that could block this. The presuppositions of scientists who don't want to believe that anti-gravity is possible, and they'll, you know, try to do everything they can do to humiliate anybody that comes up with an experiment that proves it. They'll, you know, they'll give them a hard time. They'll attack the document or the proposals or whatever they come up with. So they may encounter that. The other thing, which is more my concern, is that the people who already have anti-gravity, probably our government, really doesn't want that known. I suspect that our government already has anti-gravity technology that they reverse engineered from aliens. That's not new news. Everybody's been talking about that for years. And I'm very concerned that they might try to stop that from happening. But if the whole world is doing these magnetic experiments that I propose, and that's just one. There's others in the book. The birefringent experiment is also I'm looking into that can also prove that magnetism can cause the speed of light to go faster. So there's another possibility.
Well, yeah, we'll get around to the superluminal speed right in a moment, but I just want to come back to the anti-gravity because, well, how would your experiment differ, let's say, from Thomas Townsend Brown, who was playing around with strong electrical fields and gravity, and it, right, which produced a type of anti-gravity effect, right?
Yeah, it did. What it really did was it produced a propulsion, a pushing effect by, you know, separating the charges and inside of condensers, capacitors, and this literally created a push inside of the capacitor. So if you built them a certain way, so you had a large surface area and it had a high charge, the higher the charge, the voltage, the more that push, it could literally, after a while, just lift the craft up. It wasn't really truly anti-gravity. In my slipway bias drive, it's true anti-gravity because you surround the whole spaceship with a bubble, a field, which blocks the gravitational field underneath from the planet. It can't get through to affect that because you cause this space around the entire craft to expand, whereas the Townsend effect is just inside of the capacitors, and there's a lift or a thrust that's done in that way. So
ionic wind.
Well, they call it an ionic wind, is trying to explain it away, but it's more than an ionic wind that's causing this thrust. It's
all right. So then let's get into your experiment in some detail if we could. We've got about 4 minutes to the break, and then we'll continue after. But so, just in very simple terms, if you could explain the experiment that's in the last chapter of your book, Master of Reality.
Okay, you suspend a non-metallic object over an intense magnetic field. So the magnetic field is directly under it. You turn it on, and you can shield it if you want using shielding material, and then you suspend a wooden object or a plastic object, and you tie it to a string onto a scale, and you balance it so very sensitively. Then you turn on the magnetic field. What will happen is that device that's suspended over that magnetic field will become lighter, will weigh less, and then the scale will just tip. And the stronger you make that magnetic field, the more the gravitational field underneath it is going to be blocked. And eventually that device, whatever you got above the magnetic field, will just float.
All right. I know I said explain it in very simple terms, but that almost sounds too simple. Like, why hasn't someone figured that out already? It sounds like you're turning on a magnet.
There are a couple people that have done that and have done exactly that. Ning Li and Douglas Tor and Eugene Potvinnikoff. And they were taken in by the government and say, hey, this is an interesting idea. You know, let's go to NASA. They go to NASA. They talk about it. The next thing you know, Potvinnikoff is working for Boeing, and I don't know what happened to Ning Li. I do know she had a large payment from the government to do more research and then heard nothing. And now they're both not speaking anymore about the subject. So there is some people that have claimed that just exactly what I said, it happens. And there was like a 2% drop in the weight of these objects that were being measured, above the magnetic field. But then NASA says, well, it's not verified, and then, you know, it just kind of falls away. And so there have been, and there's probably more, but I suspect that there are people who may have discovered this phenomenon just got talked out of it because it's a top secret. It's one of the nation's probably their biggest secret, and they don't want it to get out. Because it gives us a strategic military advantage to have anti-gravity technology. But I think after 70 years, we're ahead in the game, that maybe I'm seeing signs that the government may be getting ready to announce that it exists and, you know, aliens exist. That's what I'm hoping for. And so I'm coming out and saying, do this experiment all over the world, and let's get going on this. Let's prove it, and so that we can make a better society.
All right.
Basically it.
All right, Mark. Stay put. We'll come back on the other side and talk about superluminal speed and perhaps even time travel, time permitting.